I invite you to leave your Bibles open there at the book of Hosea, and we'll be looking there this evening. And you might place a marker there, because there's nothing worse than a lesson from the minor prophets and trying to find your place back there if you leave there. So let me just tell you, that's even hard for the preacher sometimes. So I put a marker there in my Bible. We're going to be looking at Hosea as an illustration this evening, an illustration of God's love. I appreciate the presence of each and every one. I appreciate the song service, both the one preceding this worship period and then the songs led as we entered into this worship with the focus on love. Appreciate the prayer. Always appreciate the prayers on the behalf of the preacher. And so, Jacob, I appreciate you mentioning that. I wonder if people think preachers get tired of that. I never get tired of people praying for me, and I hope you never get tired of people praying for you. And I appreciate the scripture being read. I must say, it did not occur to me as I was doing that. I didn't know who had the scripture reading. And I thought, well, from the minor prophets, maybe it'll be a section with not too many. And I forgot about the Ishi and the Baali. You handled that very well. And so I appreciate you reading that scripture for us this evening. We're still considering the thought of husbands and wives. And we will move into the subject of parenting tomorrow and take that subject really through Thursday night. But in looking at the book of Hosea as an illustration of marital love and of God's design for marital love, and really that's not the primary focus. I'll get to that in just a minute, but that's where we're going to use it. It goes well beyond just the marriage love. This is just love, right? This is the depths of God's love. And when John in 1 John starts talking about how we love each other, and we do that because God first loved us, and so he is love, and we gain from that love, and we learn to love each other, this is the kind of place you can go to see what that looks like, how deep that love is. And it is. It is breathtaking how deep the love of God is. But I think another thing is I open up the book of Hosea, and that is when we're told in Ephesians chapter 5 that husbands ought to love their wives as Christ loved the church. And so we get that, at least to some degree. We understand Christ's love for the church. But ultimately, that is not, it's not a literal marriage that we're looking at there. It's figurative marriage, obviously. And I think about this too. I think, Why didn't Paul pick another example? Why didn't he pick somebody who was married? And then I think, well, who would he pick? Well, let's say maybe Adam, first husband. Well, that doesn't work out very well, does it? Things kind of seem to fall apart pretty quickly in the marriage relationship. In fact, I think Adam's abdication of his role as leader in that home is one of the things that causes things to fall apart. Well, maybe we'll just move forward a little bit. Maybe we could look at Abraham. Well, certainly Abraham is a man of faith. His name gets mentioned over and over in the New Testament. Let's take him until he takes his wife Sarah down to Pharaoh and lies to Pharaoh about her being his sister, and then does it again to a man named Abimelech in chapter 20. So, no, Abraham doesn't end up being the prime example. That debacle with Hagar is just a mess. We just keep moving forward. Let me just tell you, even when we find good men like David, we don't find a whole lot of great husbands to look up to in Scripture. Have you noticed that? I mean, as you just look through, if you ever prepared a class on marriage and you're looking for a husband to hold up and say, here's the kind of husband we need to be. And I know Christ is the best we can do. But I'm going to tell you what, there's not anything approaching that. There's not many examples approaching that. And the one that we're getting the instruction from, Paul, he himself is not even married. And so we get concept more than we get actual example. Well, here in the book of Hosea, I think we get an actual example. Here's a man who married a woman who was very hard to love. And we'll see how hard she was to love. And not only loved her at God's command, and loved her in a way that shows us, that is meant to show us, meant to show Israel, and then by virtue of being recorded us, what it looks like for God to love unlovable people. And so I want to learn from that. I want to learn from that as a husband. I want wives to learn from that. I want children, everybody in the home to understand what it means to love in the midst of difficult circumstances. Well, let's go through. Is this the remote that I'm supposed to use? All right. I saw a light here just a minute ago.
Okay.
All right. Very good. All right. Well, let's begin by understanding where we are in the book of Hosea. If you're familiar with the divided kingdom, you know that back in 1 Kings chapter 11, the kingdom was predicted that it would divide because of Solomon's unfaithfulness. And so right in the very next chapter, in the reign of Solomon's son Rehoboam, the kingdom did divide. And so we have the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. And you probably also know that the northern kingdom was filled with wicked kings, one right after another. And no matter who was on the throne, we'd go from one dynasty to another. So it wasn't just the same family like in the southern kingdom. It was different families. But no matter what family came to the throne, there was wickedness. One of the most wicked kings to ever come to the throne was Ahab. He outdid his father Omri in the wickedness that he did. And so God called up another servant to bring God's vengeance on the house of Ahab. And that servant was Jehu. And you might remember Jehu being commanded to go and to slaughter all of Ahab's household and to fulfill the prophecy to bring all of the sons of Ahab to destruction. He went in and killed Jezebel, or actually called out to someone else to throw Jezebel out of the tower. And so there's lots of bloodshed. And God is pleased. God is pleased with Jehu's actions there. And so as a reward for what he did, he gave Jehu a promise that four generations would reign on the throne. We are most of the way through those four generations as we read here in the first verse of the book of Hosea. The word of the Lord which came to Hosea, the son of Beeri, during the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. Those are the kings of the south, of Judah during this time. Kings of Judah. And during the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel. Now, this is the second Jeroboam. This is not the Jeroboam who gets mentioned over and over who made Israel to sin. This is the second Jeroboam, not related to the first. And he is one of the descendants of Jehu, and he is probably one of the most prosperous kings of the north, at least late in the kingdom. Omri would have been very prosperous as well, but Jeroboam is very prosperous. So this prophecy comes during a prosperous time. It comes a generation or two after there's been at least some going back from the wickedness that has been done in Ahab's day. One of the things God said to Jehu is, you didn't go far enough. You only took it back to where Jeroboam was at the start, which was wrong to begin with. And so you didn't go all the way back. And so Jehu is not completely commended by God. And I think some of that's going to play out in the text here. One more thing to note is that Hosea is the last call to the northern kingdom. Now, this is interesting because at the beginning of this book, it's going to be filled with the message of mercy. It's filled with the message of God's relenting from evil. It's God's forgiveness and kindness and love. And yet, as you get past chapter 3, after that first stage is set, it seems like that stage is set in order to say, and yet you have exhausted it, right? God has all of this kindness and all of this mercy, and yet you have found a way to run it out. And that seems to be Hosea's message. It's very similar to Jeremiah's message, which would be at the end of the southern kingdom. Jeremiah's message being surrender. Hope is lost. There's nothing else to cling to. There are a few messages of hope, but mostly not. And the same thing is true in Hosea. After Hosea, the prophets who come during this time will all be directed at the southern kingdom. And their message is going to be, look at what's happening up north. It'll happen to you too. And so that's the time frame in which we are looking, is the reign of Jeroboam the second. Well, picking up in verse 2 then, God gives Hosea this instruction. When the Lord first spoke through Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea, go, take to yourself a wife of harlotry and have children of harlotry. For the land commits flagrant harlotry, forsaking the Lord. So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. And we'll get in just a moment, we'll get to the names of those children. But I want to start here. that what God tells Hosea to do is to go and find a woman who's already got the reputation. All right? That is not, there was a commentary, every once in a while I pick up commentaries, especially if I'm going through some Old Testament text, and this guy said, maybe, I like to think that maybe at one time Gomer had eyes for Hosea. And Gomer really did love him, and Gomer was a good wife, and she just got led astray. That is not what this says. God says, go find a harlot. Somebody you already know is a harlot. Somebody everybody already knows is a harlot. And you go marry her. And I think that the illustration, obviously God is illustrating all throughout his relationship with the people. And I think ultimately illustrating his relationship with all people, not just with Israel. But as we think about Christ's love for the church, and that being the ultimate fulfillment of this love that God shows in the book of Hosea, God did not marry us while we were good people who just got off the rails. While we were yet sinners, Christ died for the ungodly. And so God says, go marry a people who are not good people. Go marry a woman who is not a good woman. And God calls to himself people who are not good people, who need his love, who need his help. And he's looking to raise them up greater than they are at that time. And so he points Hosea in that direction. And Hosea, let me just say a word about Hosea's faithfulness in this. Anytime you think that you are having a difficult time doing what God says, go read any of the prophets and Hosea most of all. I cannot imagine God saying, to me, go marry someone who will not be faithful to you, who will not love you back. And that is what he's being told, frankly. Because if you read out, you'll see. That's the result. She will not love you. You will get nothing in return for this. Go do it anyway. And Hosea goes and does it. And why? Why does he do it? Because I want to teach the people something. And I think if you begin to feel some sympathy for Hosea, and I do, but maybe you might think Hosea would raise up and say, this is not fair. All I can think is that God might say, you are absolutely right, it's not fair. And I live it every day. And he does. This is the life God lives right here, being played out in tangible form. Well, he goes and he marries Gomer, and it says that she does bear children. And so let's look at those children. The first one, it says, the Lord said to him, name him Jezreel. Now, we know names in the Bible always have some meaning, and of course, these names are going to have meaning. Name him Jezreel. Now, sometimes you can go and you can look up the definitions, but also just notice what the text will tell you about why. Why name him Jezreel? For yet a little while, and I will punish the house of Jehu for the bloodshed of Jezreel. All right, so in this name, the meaning is not... it's not in the definition, but it is in the association of place. So what is Jezreel? Well, I mentioned earlier that Jehu had brought judgment on the house of Ahab. And one of the aspects of the judgment is that he had gotten all of the sons of Ahab and he had slaughtered them. And he had done so in the valley of Jezreel. Now, what's interesting is that God is pointing to that occasion where Jehu did the very thing that has caused his house to be rewarded, up to the point that now the one sitting on the throne is a son of Jehu who is actually prospering at this time. And God says, I'm bringing judgment on his house for the bloodshed of Jezreel. Now, two things about that. The first one is this. I think that here are people who, like so many Israelites and like so many of us, have gotten comfortable in thinking that God is blessing them. And they think judgment can't come upon them. And God is using the very location of what has started this late blessing in Israel's history to say that what happened to Ahab's house, the thing that you thought would set you up, and I'm not going to disturb you because of what happened to Jezreel. No, I'm going to use that to remind you that it can come for you too. They're going to be destroyed. And so Jezreel becomes the reminder of that. It becomes the pointer to say, do you remember the bloodshed? And if you read through the story of Jehu and Ahab's household, it is one of those stories 8-year-old boys love to read. It is full of blood and guts. And he says, that's what I want you to think of. Judgment is coming. I think the other thing is this, that Jehu partially did what God wanted, but not entirely. And if you ever get comfortable thinking that you can do part of what God wants, but not everything, here's a story for you. God says, I want to remind you of Jezreel. You think you have my favor because you did a little bit of what I said? No. Ultimately, that will end in judgment. And so God wants our whole allegiance, not just partial allegiance. And so he calls that up and he reminds them of that. And on that day, he says, I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. So And with the first child, he points him back to that occasion. Then she conceived again, verse 6. Picking up there, it says she conceived again and gave birth to a daughter this time. And the Lord said to him, name her Lo-Ruhamah. For, again, we get the explanation here. For I will no longer have compassion on the house of Israel, and that I will ever forgive them. But I will have compassion on the house of Judah and deliver them by the Lord their God, and will not deliver them by bow. I will not deliver them by bow, sword, battle, horses, or horsemen. Well, we'll see in just a moment. She's got another son, but let's start with Lo-Ruhamah. This one does give us the definition. Lo means not or no. Ruhamah means mercy, grace, or compassion. And so when he says, I will no longer have compassion, he's saying, I'll no longer have Ruhamah for the house of Israel. And can you just imagine? Here are people. We talk about God's grace a lot. Entirely appropriate. We should talk about God's grace a lot. We're going to talk about that tonight. So we define God by his mercy. God defines himself by his mercy. All the way back in Exodus chapter 32, when he didn't destroy the people after they built a golden calf, that one of the first things he says, this is who I am. I am a God of mercy and kindness and compassion. And so we harp on that, and the world harps on that until we think there's nothing else but compassion and mercy there. And God says, here's what I want you to do. I want you to name your child. I want you to communicate with the name of your child. The mercy has run out. So, at the outset, understand that no matter how deep our love is for someone, there is a time to cut off. There is a time to separate. And that's what God is saying. The time is coming where we've got to separate. So I'm going to say a lot of things tonight. I'm going to say a lot of things about what we should put up with. But understand, even at the outset of all of that God is going to say what he will put up with, he starts by saying, but not everything. Like, I will draw the line somewhere eventually. And I will say, no grace. There'll be a time when the people will come and say, mercy, mercy. And there will be no mercy, no compassion. When she had weaned Lo-Ruhamah, she conceived and gave birth to a son. And the Lord said, name him Lo-Ammah, for you are not my people, and I am not your God. It might be well to read this in this manner. Name him not my people, for you are not my people. Right? So it's just repeating what he says. Because that is the fact of the matter. Name him this because you are not. I think there may be some double meaning there. Not my people. When Hosea goes and marries a wife of harlotry, the next thing it tells us is that she bore him children, or God says she will bear you children of harlotry. Who are children of harlotry? Well, they're not their daddy's children, to put it politely. And I think that's part of the situation here. They're not. And as the people would play the harlot with the other nations and they would bear children, and those children may have some connection to Abraham physically. But what Paul will show us in the New Testament, those who are Israel have become not Israel. They're not his people. And they lose that connection. They become children of the world and not children of God. And so that's communicated here. you are not my people and I am not your God. That ought to strike us. It certainly should have struck them. I hope that it did. I like to think that surely there is somebody who would have listened to that and been struck by the notion of God saying, you're not my people and I am not your God. Because that phrase, I will be your God and you will be my people, or you'll be my people and I will be your God, is the key phrase of God and his people. And for God to say, it's over, it's done, it is striking. Well, picking up then in verse 10, I want to suggest that even now there remains hope, just like as we look through the book of Jeremiah and we find some hope in the midst of all the prophecy of destruction. He says here, say to your brothers, am I? Well, let's pick back to verse 10. Yet the number of the sons of Israel will be like the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured or numbered. And in the place where it is said to them, you are not my people, it will be said to them, you are the sons of the living God. And the sons of Judah and the sons of Israel will be gathered together, for they will appoint for themselves one leader, and they will go up from the land, for great will be the day of Jezreel. Say to your brothers, am I? And to your sisters, Ruhamah. There will be a time where God still shows mercy. In other words, mercy's running out for this generation, but not for people everywhere. And not even for these people. And so again, Paul would call this language up in the book of Romans. And he would say that God left the door open, right? And that is one thing that we see with God, is that while there is breath, the door is open. The door is open for reconciliation. And so he points, I believe, in a very messianic way to saying there's coming a time, and certainly Paul uses it in that messianic way. There's coming a time when there will be, from the sons of Israel, those who rise up and become sons of God once again. And so all hope is not lost, but hope is lost for the ones who continue down the path that they're on. It's really beautiful as you get over into the second verse there of chapter 2, and you think about the symbolism pointing forward to the church being my people, the church being those who have the compassion of God. And he says, now contend with your mother. Contend, for she is not my wife, and I am not her husband. And let her put away her harlotry from her face and her adultery from between her breasts, or I will strip her naked and expose her as on the day when she was born. And I will also make her like a wilderness, make her like a desert land, and slay her with thirst. And also I will have no compassion on her children, because they are children of harlotry. For their mothers played the harlot. She who conceived them has acted shamefully. For she said, I will go after my lovers who give me bread and my water and my wool and my flax and my oil and my drink. And therefore, behold, I will hedge up her way with thorns, and I will build a wall against her so that she cannot find her paths. She will pursue her lovers, but she will not overtake them. She will seek them, but will not find them. And then she will say, I will go back to my husband, for it was better for me than now. For she does not know that it was I who gave her the grain, the new wine, and the oil, and lavished on her silver and gold, which they used for Baal. Therefore, I will take back my grain at harvest time and my new wine in its season, and I will also take away my wool and my flax given to cover her nakedness, and I will uncover her lewdness in the sight of her lovers, and no one will rescue her out of my hand. I will also put an end to all her gaiety, her feasts, her new moons, her Sabbaths, and all her festal assemblies. I will destroy her vines and fig trees, of which she said, these are my wages, which my lovers have given me. And I will make them a forest, and the beasts of the field will devour them. I will punish her for the days of the Baals, when she used to offer sacrifices to them and adorn herself with earrings and jewelry and follow her lovers so that she forgot me, declares the Lord. So what's the picture there? Well, first of all, the picture is children who now are my people, children who are children of compassion, go talk to your mother and try to get her to see what's going on. Again, reminiscent of what Paul says there in Romans chapter 11, when he's talking he's been talking to the Jews, and he turns his attention a little bit now towards the Gentiles, and he says, listen, they fail. so that there might be room for you to come and be grafted into the tree. But all of that's to try to bring them back too. Right? As the Gentiles came in, they needed to turn around and try to bring the Jews in with them. Oh, it's a beautiful picture here of what's going to happen. But I tell you another thing that's interesting to me is what it says, that she's depended on everybody else. And then what's going to happen is she's going to say, one day she's going to say, well, it was better under my husband. It was better with God. And what's God going to say? No. No famine is what you're going to get now. You're going to get death and destruction. And so the idea is, call to her before that day. Don't come to God like this. And everyone will bow the knee. Everyone one day will cry to God for mercy. My prayer is that you will do that before you're looking at Him at the judgment day. Because that's the day there will be lo ruhamah. It'll be done. God's offered it all your life, over and over. You've rejected that. And one day you'll say, yes, now I want this. I don't want the fate of my friends. Lo ruhamah. Death and destruction. And so He calls to her. Well, all of that sets the stage, I think, for the display of love that God shows in the rest of the first three chapters, the rest of chapter 2 and chapter 3. We're going to skip over to chapter 3, and then we're going to come back to chapter 2 and verse 14, which was read for us earlier, and we'll use that as our closing point this evening. Well, look at chapter 3, beginning in verse 1. It says, "Then the Lord said to me, 'Go again, love a woman who is loved by her husband, yet an adulteress. Even as the Lord loves the sons of Israel, though they turn to other gods and love raisin cakes.'" I gotta say, when I see raisin cakes there, it just seems so incongruous, right? There's so much serious going on. It says, and they love raisin cakes. But I do think there is something to be said for that sort of incongruous word in there. Because in Israel, what you have is people who regularly refer to the things that they love. And for instance, when they're coming out, especially during the Exodus, when they're coming back out of Egypt and they're complaining about bitter water, they're complaining about being hungry. And then ultimately, when they come up to the promised land, literally the promised land, right? So we say that figuratively all the time. That is literally the promised land. It's got all the land flowing with milk and honey. It is truly a blessed place. And they come right up to the southern border there at Kadesh Barnea. The spies come back and they tell them what's there. And they said, let's go back. Let's go back to Egypt. Why? Doesn't it sound so silly? Because there we had onions. Yeah. I mean, I know. I mean, I get it. It was slavery. It was really bad. But hey, onions. So, yeah. Does it look foolish for it to compare God to raisin cakes? Yes. That's what people do. They take small, insignificant, silly, petty things, and they say, for love of this, I will turn my back on God. And I think that's the idea here, is this is a person for such a pittance will sell God out. But what does God say? He says to Hosea, you go love her. And here's the first key. Love is something that we offer, that we do, that we put into action, and we do not do it in response to. Love is not something, at least deep, lasting, true love. The love God commands is not a responsive love. It is a proactive love. That's what we find in Matthew chapter 5 when Jesus is saying, don't greet who? Don't greet the ones that greet you. Don't just respond to love. Don't just respond to kindness. You go love who? Your enemies. The one that slaps you in the face. The one that takes your stuff. The one that presses you into service and says, go with me a mile. And what do? You outdo them in kindness. Paul reiterates that theme in Romans chapter 12 when he talks about loving our enemies. Here, what do? You return kindness. If there's a return, it is a return of love for evil. The only one that we should be thinking in terms of responsive love to is God Himself, because we can never be proactive in loving God. We love Him because He first loved us. You can't get in front of God's love. But when it comes to anybody else, and when it comes to the marriage relationship, we love first. And sometimes people will say with regards to their marriage, but my marriage relationship, the love is a one-way street. I'm the only one who gives. I give, and I never get back. And that is the case sometimes. Now, a lot of times that's not the case. A lot of times we imagine things. It kind of, you know, you ever say, you never do this. And then what do, husbands? We say, well, now hold on. I know that I have done something other than what you just said on occasion. Now, incidentally, husbands, that's not what they mean. They don't literally mean never. Say that word, but it's not what they mean. And so we're ready to let the record show. No, it's not the idea. But we do make things up in our heads. But I think there are marriages that absolutely are one-way street. I think there are people who love their spouses and their spouses do not care one whit for them. And what does God say? Every day. All the time. I love and I love and I love, and it's a one-way street. And so who are we to come to God and say, it's all me? And God says, it's all you. What about here? It is literally all God. And so we come and it humbles us. And any time, I think one of the key elements to getting past so many relationships, not every relationship problem, but so many of our relationship problems, is we feel entitled. We feel entitled to better treatment. And getting past that and understanding that, no, I don't deserve better treatment. Now, maybe on the human plane, maybe between me and this other person, there is some deserving. But on the eternal plane, no. You know what I deserve? I deserve hell. That's what I deserve. And the fact that I'm breathing right now, the fact that I'm sitting here in an air-conditioned, cooled building, you're sitting in comfortable chairs. Why? Because God is gracious, and He does not give us what we deserve. And so when we go to God and we say, it's not fair, let me just tell you, what I want from God is never what is fair. I don't want Him to treat me with fairness. I want Him to treat me with compassion and kindness and love. And so He says to Hosea, you go love someone. Who do you go love? The person who I am telling you does not love you and will not love you. I'm talking about love as a decision. That's what He tells Hosea to do. Well, verse 2. So I bought her, he says. I bought her for myself for 15 shekels of silver and a homer and a half of barley. That sort of leads to the question, who is Hosea buying his wife from? It's already his wife. And even from the standpoint of wives being considered as property, which I think that may be not necessarily a good way to view that from the scriptural standpoint, but even if you were to put it in those kinds of terms, she's his. So who's he buying her from? Well, it seems that she has gone and made herself the property of someone else. Now, what do we call that? We call that slavery. And so what's she done? I don't know if she sold herself into some kind of situation. And here Hosea comes and he gets her out of that situation. And I think about that in terms of us and love that we have for someone. Love means I want what's best for you and I will do whatever I can to get that for you. And I think of all the times where I have gone through the mental exercise and maybe even said it to people, you have made this bed and now you will sleep in it. Can I say God has every right to say that to us? Hosea has every right to say that to Gomer. And God says, no, don't do that. You go pay the price. And what price does he pay? To strengthen the notion that he's buying her out of slavery, if you look over in Exodus chapter 21 and verse 32, you've got lots of property valuations and laws concerning slavery. And one of the aspects of slavery is that if your servant is gored by an ox, injured, then what the person who owned the ox has to do is pay you. And they have to pay you 30 shekels of silver, which should sound familiar. They have to pay you 30 shekels of silver. It's the price of a slave. Now, what it looks like to me is that Hosea's got 15, and then he's got to add to it whatever other goods he can to go pay the price of a servant. And he buys her back. He buys her out of slavery that she has gotten herself into. And what has God done for us? Here we have made ourselves in bondage to sin. And God comes and he doesn't say, well, this is a fine mess you've gotten yourself into. What are you calling on me for? He comes and he says, I will pay the price. And how much will it cost? Everything. And he'll pay with his own life. And so to buy us back, God has gone through agony and torment, and he has paid the awful price to buy us back, even though we were responsible. Don't think that if someone else has made a mess of things, that we have the right to lord over them, to stand over them and say, look, you made this mess. I realize there's a place for, letting people suffer the consequences of their decisions. I understand all of that. God understands all of that. We see as you go through the rest of the book, that's what he's about to do with these people. But don't start there. I think that's where we start sometimes. And God doesn't start there. He starts with, I will try, I will do my best, I will pull you out of this. So he tells Hosea, you go buy her back. That is the kind of love. That is the kind of love that people need to know that we have, that our spouses need to know that we have for them. Then it says, then I said to her, you shall stay with me. You shall stay with me for many days. You shall not play the harlot. You shall, nor shall you have a man. So I will be toward you. For the sons of Israel will remain for many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or sacred pillar, and without ephod or household idols. Afterward, the sons of Israel will return and seek the Lord their God and David their king, and they will come trembling to the Lord and to his goodness in the last days. Again, bleeding over into the messianic language, there is going to come a time. This is going to get bad, truly. They're going to be without king. They're going to be without prince. But after that, they're going to be sons of Israel. What is it? True Israel. Who will return and seek the Lord their God and David their king. And they will come to the Lord and to his goodness in the last days. Can I suggest to you that the reward of being a loving person is very often delayed. Very often you don't see it in the immediate. And sometimes you may not even see it till you see God. But the reward is there. And God is going to give reward when we follow his pattern, when we love those who are, as in this case, unlovable. So it's all very difficult. And yet he's calling Hosea to go find her, to go bring her back, to pay the price, whatever it costs, to bring her back. Well, let's come back over to chapter 2 then, and let's consider this song that's written there. Hosea 2, picking up in verse 14 that we had read for us earlier. How will God get her back? And I think we combine this with what he tells Hosea. This is how he's going to get her back. Therefore, behold, I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak kindly to her. So that's how he starts. You know, just a moment ago I said we don't start by telling people, well, this is your mess, you're going to have to live with it. No, he starts with, come back to me. He starts with kindness and tenderness. I will speak softly to her. Let me ask you, when you're thinking about people that you're supposed to love, how do you start? I mean, there are some people that I feel like when we walk into the same room together, if we speak civil words, have you ever had that kind of relationship with people? If we speak civil words, that's a plus, right? That's a good day. And particularly, you know, when you're growing up and your siblings, you're having trouble getting along. You know, you think, speak, you know, my parents would say, just speak kindly. I say these things to my children. Speak kindly. I'm saying, speak kindly. I mean, I didn't hit her this morning. Isn't that good enough? No. Persuade. Allure, he says. That's what I'm going to do. Can I suggest to you that we are not owed this response from God? Gomer is not owed this response at all. And that God has every right to come in and speak harshly, to lay down the law, to tell her what a horrible person she is. And he comes in and he says, this is the tack I'm going to take. I'm going to allure her. I'm going to bring her into the wilderness. And I'm going to speak kindly to her. Going on to verse 15. Then I will give her vineyards from the valley of Achor as a door of hope. And she will sing there as in the days of her youth, as in the day when she came up from the land of Egypt. I think in this part right here, we have hope where there was not hope. He says in verse 18, in addition to this, in that day I will make a covenant for them with the beasts of the field, the birds of the sky, and the creeping things of the ground. And I will abolish the bow and the sword and war from the land and make them lie down in safety. And so the idea is that where there tends to be things that cause apprehension and lack of peace, I'm going to make that places of peace. But going back to verse 15, he mentions the Valley of Achor. What's the Valley of Achor? Well, that's over where Achan was called out. If you remember the story of Achan, that's after they had taken the city of Jericho, and God told the people there in Joshua chapter 6, don't take any of the spoils. Achan did. And in the next chapter, Israel suffers defeat, and they figure out what's going on, what's wrong, and it boils down to Achan. He confesses of his sin, produces the goods that he took from Jericho, and he and his family are stoned to death and then burned. And that happens in Achor. So, if you think in their history, when Achor comes up, that can't be like a pleasant place to think about, right? Achor, a message of hope. No. It's like Achor. That's where we killed Achan and his family. But he says here, he says, the Valley of Achor as a door of hope. I think about this in terms of Jesus. In terms of Jesus, it is, when they crucified him, what did they do but opened up the fountain that would be the very thing that would cleanse their own sins? All right, so in the crucifixion of Jesus, in that place of no hope, the place of the skull, the cross, that emblem of death and shame, now people wear them. We could talk about the wisdom of that, but nevertheless, people look to the cross, and we talk about the cross, and we say, the cross, as Paul says, our glory in it. And so something that had been a symbol of shame turns into a symbol of hope. I know that in my relationship, that with my wife, working through failures on either one of our parts brings us to a greater place. It makes our relationship stronger. So that at times we look back, if we work through those failures, we are able to look back and not be thankful for the failures, don't get me wrong, but we look back and we say, we are better for having gotten through that. And so moving through those places of shame and sorrow, I think even can make those times, it can bring hope to mind instead of shame to mind. Well, back up to verse 19. He says, I will betroth you to me forever. Yes, I will betroth you to me in righteousness and in justice and loving kindness and compassion. I will betroth you to me in faithfulness. And then you will know the Lord. That idea of betroth you to me, it speaks to going back to the beginning. That is the beginning of the relationship. It is similar to our being engaged, but it's not quite, because it's much more binding of a relationship. It's the beginning of marriage. And so when he says, I will betroth you, he's talking to the children of Israel who are already his bride, But he says in this case, I'm going to allure you. I'm going to speak kindly. I'm going to make hope out of shame. I'm going to betroth you to me. We're going to go back to the beginning. When I think about that, I think about how many times I've sat down with husbands and wives who have made a wreck of their lives, a wreck of their marriages. And I do what my grandfather has done and what other men have advised me to do. I try to remind them about why they got married in the first place. I try to remind them about who they said they loved on that day. Take them back to that day in some way and try to get them to move, to step back from all the damage that's been done and say, okay, what did that look like? And can we get back there? And I want to tell you, there's a lot of people that say we can't go back. God has a right to say, we can't go back. But he doesn't. He says, I'll take you back like none of this ever happened. Go back to the betrothal. And we'll set it back at square one. And if we come to God and we say, I can't do that, I hope God doesn't say that. God says, I'll wipe the slate clean. And oh, to be able to do that in our relationships with each other. To forget about all the wrongs and all the harms and all the hurtful things that have been said. All the unkindnesses and all the little annoyances that have built up over a life together. Until we just can't hardly stand to look at each other anymore. And we let all that happen and God says, we'll go back to the beginning. Newlyweds. Would you like that? I'd like that. And so he calls us to that kind of love. He says in that, then you will know the Lord. And I believe that word, know the Lord, or that phrase, know the Lord, is significant. Because I think it is, especially in the context of the husband and wife relationship, it is the same language that is used over and over again to talk about the sexual relationship between men and women. So Adam knew Eve, and that's this word, know the Lord. Now, I know you might be thinking there for just a moment, might be thinking, well, that's a bit much to be thinking about spiritual terms intermixed with the sexual relationship. Well, a couple things let me say about that. First of all, if that makes you feel tawdry, then you have learned more about the sexual relationship from the world than from God. All right, look at His Word and see what it says about that and about what that ought to mean and the deeper meaning of that relationship. Secondly, it's no more weird than Jesus saying, eat my flesh and drink my blood. And so when he says you will know the Lord, I think that in multiple ways. First of all, you'll know me and only me. You'll know nobody else like me. And secondly, you'll know me and you'll know me more deeply than anybody else. And I think you get to know people, you draw closer to people than ever before when they do what God says He'll do here, when they are willing to forgive. When they're willing to forgive great wrongs, wrongs that we don't deserve to have forgiven. And God says, when I do that, when I set it back and I betroth you to me, you will know me. And that is how we know God. Is that He is willing to forgive all these wrongs and exercise this loving kindness and compassion. Well, finally then, skip back to verse 16. It will come about in that day, declares the Lord, that you will call me Ishi and will no longer call me Baali. So if you look back through the Old Testament at these two words, the word Baali is generally, it's used, translated as husband in several cases. But almost in every case it's translated husband, the affection of the relationship is nowhere to be found. It's more like regulations, right? Regulations between husbands and wives. The husband has this right over his wife, and it involves valuations and so forth. And so there's a lot more of a transactional relationship. He's the master, she is the servant. But that Ishi is also translated husband, and it is where there's affection. And so on that day, you won't just call me by the transactional name husband, but you'll call me husband in the sense of someone that loves you, someone that you know loves you. And so what he says is, you're not just going to look at God as your master, but as someone who cares for you. And this is where we really get to deep relationships with each other, deep relationships in our marriage, is when we look across, when we look across the room, and what we see is, that's a person who has my best interests at heart. And that I can trust that. That I can know that. And so we can say, that's my wife. And I'm her husband. And we say that with joy. And that's where God ends up here in this love song, here in the last verse. I will say to those who are not my people, you are my people. And they will say, you are my God. Because what we've got right now is God saying, I want you to be my people. And they're saying, well, we don't want you to be our God. He says, we're going to turn that around. We're going to change that. We're going to transform that. I think we can transform our homes. We can transform our lives. You might want to blank that. I don't know how to do that. That if we would have the kind of radical love that comes in and says, today, you go home and you say, I'm going to decide to love my spouse today. I'm going to decide to love my children. I'm going to decide to love my parents. I'm going to decide to love my siblings. And I'm going to make that decision regardless of what they say when we walk in the door. Don't care. I've decided what I'm going to do. You see, that's what God's doing here. Do you see that is what he's telling Hosea? This is you. You've decided you're going to love. But she's going to do this. You've already decided. Doesn't matter what she does. This is how you're going to behave. This is the key element to relationships. If we go through life waiting for the other side to get better before we improve, all our relationships will be garbage. God tells us that over and over in so many ways. And the reason we have a relationship with God is because he doesn't do that. Because if he does that, nobody gets a relationship with God. God comes in and says, no matter what you do, I will do this. Put him on a cross, put him to death, spit on him and mock him. He still has decided, I will love you. As I said this morning, it's a high bar. It's a high bar, and Hosea shows us just how high that bar is. I hope that you are affected. I hope that you will see God is alluring you and has spoken kindly to you and is drawing you to himself. And that he will betroth you to him. He will set it back at square one. He will wipe the slate clean. No matter what you've done, if he would do it for them, he will do it for you. And if you're here this evening and you are someone who wants that kind of love, I hope that you'll come forward accepting it from our Lord while we stand and while we sing.